Joining me to ask questions of our two panelists is Deborah Blum, a journalist, author, and UW professor. Deborah's newspaper series on primate research won the 1992 Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting and led to her outstanding book, The Monkey Wars. She's also the author of a book on UW primate researcher Harry Harlow. Our panelists tonight are, to my right, Dr. Eric Sandgren, a professor of pathobiological sciences and chair of the All-Campus Animal Care and Use Committee, and, to my left, Rick Bogle of the Alliance for Animals Primate Freedom Project. I especially want to thank Dr. Sandgren for agreeing to this debate, which is something animal welfare advocates have been wanting for years. It takes a lot of courage for Dr. Sandgren to appear here, contrary to the wishes of some of his peers. I think this shows his genuine commitment to open discussion and deserves to be commended. Whether this debate is the first of many or an isolated occurrence will depend in part on the conduct of our audience. Be apprised, there are people on both sides of this issue who are hoping the other side will behave badly in order to discredit them. Let's try to make sure those people go home disappointed. A final thought. Someone skeptical about this event asked me, what good will it do? So we have this discussion and both sides make their case. How will that change anything? And the honest answer is, if people come to this debate with hardened positions and closed minds, it may not accomplish much of anything. And so, for at least the next 90 minutes, I urge us all to consider that both sides have valid points and that neither has a monopoly on the truth.
We're having a sound issue. I'm having some sort of something.
Yeah, your mic just disappeared. No, it just quit for addressing.
Hello, hello. I think we're back in business here.
Okay. Thank you. I would like... Yeah, that's what I think. Thank you. I'm keeping it. I would like to join Bill in thanking our panelists, the event sponsors, and I would like to thank Bill himself, who has worked tirelessly. to make this a successful event. I join with him in urging, as T.H. White once wrote, that we endeavor tonight to shed light and not heat. I've been writing about animal research for most of my science writing life, and I believe now, as I have from the beginning, that there are valid points on both sides of this discussion, and that those points have their best chance of being acted on if we actually take the time to hear them. With that, I would like to review the format of tonight's debate, beginning with the standard request to please turn off your cell phones and pagers if they are still on. They tend to be very disruptive in these kinds of events. After that, this is the basic structure of tonight. There will be 7.5-minute opening statements from each of our panelists. Then Bill and I will take turns asking questions of the panelists. The person who has asked the question will have 2 minutes to respond, and the other panelists will have 1 minute to reply. A timekeeper, seated here, will let the panelists know how much time is left and when their time is up. During this portion of the program, the audience is invited to submit questions on cards that have been handed out and which are available at the back of the room. The questions should be directed to one or the other of the panelists. You have until 7:50 to ask your questions and pass them to the end of the aisle where they will be collected. We hope to devote 25 minutes to these questions starting at 8 p.m. The questions will be reviewed first by Vicki Kratz of Isthmus and then by the questioners, that would be Bill and I, with the goal of picking the best, presenting as much of a balance as possible and avoiding repetition. As a moderator of this portion of the event, I will ask the questions of the panelists to whom they are directed and may at my discretion allow the other panelists to reply. Responses to these questions will be limited to 1 minute, although both the panelists should know that it's fine to answer in a shorter time than that. At the end of this portion of the program, each panelist will have 2 minutes for closing remarks. With that, let us start with opening remarks from Dr. Sengren.
Thank you. I'd also like to welcome all of you, and before I go any further, I'll ask, is this microphone working?
Little red button on the back.
So I can speak fairly loudly while we deal with these issues. Oh. Okay. This one still work over here? Okay. So I'd like to welcome you all to what actually is the fourth interaction on this campus between faculty who use animals in research and activists who don't believe animals should be used in research. So this is not a new thing here. I'd like to start... Still can't hear me? Okay. I'll hold it. Does this work? Okay. So again, I'd like to welcome you to the fourth interaction between animal activists and faculty who use animals in research on this campus over the course of the last number of years. I'd like to start by giving you some sense of how I came here, but I'd have to be able to understand that first, so I really don't have too much to say about that. I do have some experience with the regulation of the use of animals in research on this campus. I'm part of several committees that review all animal work before it can be conducted, and I'm guessing the character of those committees and some of their functioning will come out in some of the questioning later on. Most recently, I've been appointed as the chair of the All-Campus Animal Care and Use Committee, and that's an oversight committee that really is in charge of reviewing the whole animal care program on campus. In an issue like this, where there is a lot of societal contention, I think the best place to start is with ethics, and that is to really put what we're talking about into a context. And so that's what I'm going to do for the first few minutes of the my introductory statements. There is an ethical background to the position that animals should not be used in research. There is an ethical background to the position that animals can be used in research. And I think if we provide that, if we all have that in mind as a context right from the start, it will help to sharpen the focus of the debate that we have after this. When I started myself to try to identify so that I could put into words what these ethics were, I thought it was a hopelessly complex problem because I think everyone in this room has a slightly different perspective on the issue. But really, it actually came down to being something that's quite simple. And just so you know that I'm not presenting a perspective that's biased in my direction, I'm taking the words that I'm using from an animal rights supporter and writer, Gary Francione, who actually does a very good job of summarizing the issue. So that's where I'm getting the basic information that I'm using right now. So there's a long history of thought regarding animals and how they are used, how they interact with humans. And a utilitarian, Jeremy Bentham, in the 1700s, made a statement that is used now, actually, sometimes in animal activist literature. And he stated, the question is not can they reason, nor can they talk, but can they suffer? So he was pointing out that the ability to feel pain must be a consideration when you determine how you are to use animals. He was a utilitarian, and the definition of utilitarianism is, and by the way, since I'm a faculty member, I'm required in every presentation I get to provide at least 2 long, boring quotes, and so this is the first one. Utilitarianism is the view that an action is right if and only it produces a better balance of benefits and harms than available alternative actions. So there's some really important concepts embedded in there. The notion of balance between benefit and harm.
So in order to make an ethical decision as a utilitarian, you have to understand the benefits, you have to understand the potential harm. And Peter Singer took up on this in his Animal Liberation in 1975. He's one of several people who's been termed the father of animal rights, although he actually does not believe in animal rights per se. I'll talk about what that is in a minute. He is a utilitarian and believes that given that animals can suffer, that outweighs any benefits that we could gain by using them in experimental research. So he kind of has a set point on one end of that particular extreme. The next issue, and I just referred to this, was the issue of animal rights. That is the other principal perspective from which animal activists address the use of animals in any sense. And here's my second quote, rights, moral actions that grow out of respect for the individual. They build protective fences around the individual. They establish areas where the individual is entitled to be protected against the state and the majority, even when a price is paid by the general welfare. That's a quote from Bernard Rollin. He discusses animal welfare and animal rights, and he's going to be speaking this weekend on campus as well. So in the case of animal rights, then, it's a very different perspective from the utilitarian perspective of animal welfare. Gary Francione points out that if you believe in animal rights, if you support animal rights, then you have to work to eliminate the use of animals as property, because as long as animals are property, then they can't have any rights independent of those who own them. And there has been actually a legal movement lately to give animals certain rights. So where does this then, okay, so those are the two principal perspectives that the animal activists generally follow, although again there's some very complex mixtures. Where does that put the individuals who choose to use animals in research, who believe that that's right? Well, what I'd like to do is read from the U.S. government principles for the utilization and care of vertebrate animals used in testing, research, and training. And these are the guidelines that govern both legally and in many respects financially the use of animals in biomedical research. So one of the principles that we have to follow is that procedures involving animals should be designed and performed with due consideration of their relevance to human or animal health, the advancement of knowledge, or the good of society. So clearly there's a balancing requirement there. Another, animals selected for a procedure should be of an appropriate species and quality and the minimum number required to obtain valid results. Methods such as mathematical models, computer simulation, and in vitro biological systems should be considered. Again, comparing the actions of using animals versus other potential actions that might address important questions. And then proper use of animals includes the avoidance and minimization of discomfort, distress, and pain, and in many cases requires the use of specific analgesic agents or anesthetic agents. So based on those guidelines, and that really is what guides the work that we do, it's clear that those of us who believe in animal research also are utilitarians. And the scary thing about that is that it means that really there may only be two differences between Rick Vogel and myself. He speaks from a utilitarian perspective, and he just sets the balance point in a different place than I do. The second difference is he has a lot more hair than I do. So, Rick, over to you.
I don't know who has the device that's doing that, but you have to leave. And I don't think we're going to go on until we find out where that noise is coming from. I think it's in the room. I don't think so either. It's not like feedback that I've ever heard before. Where's it coming from? Is that it? Is that is good? Can I start? All right. Well, thanks to everybody who came. I think it's amazing. Everybody in the room, I know we have widely divergent views. Some of us don't know how we stand. Some of us are absolutely sold one way or the other. But one thing that we all have in common is that we all think that the issue is important enough to come out on such a beautiful spring evening and listen to what we both have to say. So thank you very much for coming out. And of course, thank you to the University Union Directorate and Deborah Blum for moderating and coming up with questions, and Eric Sangren for having the gumption to come and participate. And a special thank you to Isthmus and Bill Leaders for organizing this and recognizing the desirability and the interest in the public to actually try to put something like this on. I hope the university recognizes just the fact that all of you came, that there is an interest in the community. I know that Eric said that this has happened now, or excuse me, I want to be polite. Dr. Sangren said that this has happened now for the fourth time that this has happened on campus. The last time it happened on campus was about 7.5 or 8 years ago, and I took part in that debate. It hasn't happened on campus in nearly 8 years. That's not a sign that the university is entertaining very much discussion about the issue, at least in the public venue. Tonight, let me tell you that I'm going to make a number of claims, and the claims that I'm going to make tonight, I hope I can substantiate right here at this time. I'll let Eric talk about what the animal rights people have to say, and I'm going to tell you what the scientists have to say. And we'll start. My 4 points are these, that there's ample evidence out there that shows that monkeys have minds that are very similar to our own, that they have emotions very similar to our own, and that, in fact, they understand the golden rule. That's my first point, and I'm going to go over that in some detail in a second. Let me go through my other real quickly here. The oversight's not working. The oversight system is broken. It's broken at the national level and the local level, and I'm going to offer you evidence for that tonight. And it doesn't work, and I'm also going to offer you evidence about that tonight. The evidence that I'm going to offer you tonight all comes from as reliable a sources as I know how to find. So let me start with my first bit of evidence. And this is a study that was done by Masserman, by Jules Masserman. Now, I don't know if you know who Jules Masserman is. He was the president of the American Society of Psychiatry for a couple of years. He was the president of the World Association of Psychiatry. I may have the name actually a little bit. It's the American Psychiatric Association and the World Association for Social Psychiatry. He was, one writer called him the most prominent psychiatrist in the world. Masserman wrote a study called, in fact, I have the study with us, if we want to look at it. It's called Altruistic Behavior in Rhesus Monkeys. This is what Masserman did, he and some colleagues. They built a box, and the box had two parts to it, that you could put a monkey on each side of these boxes. In one part, one half, they put a monkey, and they trained the monkey to pull chains when a certain light order flashed. So once the monkey learned how to do that, he would do it, and then he would receive a food reward, or she. They used monkeys of both genders. So once the monkey learned how to do that, then they put a monkey in the other box. Oh, I should tell you also that this was happening in 1964, so this is not a new study. This is something that everybody in the industry should be very familiar with, written by a very well-known author. So once they knew how to pull the chains and they got the little bit of food, then they put another monkey in the other side of the box. This time when the monkey pulled the chains to get the food reward, the other monkey received a painful electric shock. It took a little while, but once the monkeys understood that them pulling the chains resulted in the other monkey getting a shock, most of the monkeys quit pulling the chains. In one of the cases, one of the monkeys went without eating for 12 days. Because he refused to shock another monkey. It sounds like the golden rule. The monkeys who had been in the chamber previously receiving the shock were even less likely to pull the chains to shock somebody on the other side. So my point about animal mind, specifically about the 2,000 monkeys that are housed here at the Primate Center, some of whom are housed in an individual cage alone for their entire life, is that we know that these animals are experiencing the world in very similar ways to ourselves. We know that the way that they react with each other is very similar to the way that you and I react to each other on our best days. There's tons of evidence about this. I'm going to only give you, for each one of my claims right now, just the one that I think is the most authoritative piece. I'm going to stick with that, with Masterman. My second piece, the oversight system is broken. How authoritative can we get? How about a Office of the Inspector General from the United States Department of Agriculture published in 2005? This is a recent study. Let me just go through really quickly and quote some of the things. The eastern region, now this is the way this works. I don't have much time. I'm going to talk very quickly, and some people get upset because I talk too fast, but I have so much to say. The way that oversight works is that the federal government, I have 2 minutes, there's no way. Okay. Okay, so I'm just going to let it go with that. The inspector general says that the system doesn't work. The local system doesn't work. There was a study published in 2002 in Science, not some fly-by-night journal. Klaus and Herzog looked at IACUCs. They looked at 50 studies they gave them that were approved by local IACUCs. This is the local control, the committee, the sort of thing that Dr. Sangren chairs. These were approved protocols. They sent these 50 protocols out to other universities. More than half of the protocols came back as refused. They said they were unintelligible, it didn't make any sense, the science was poor, this wasn't a good use of animals, the animals were going to be hurt unnecessarily. They couldn't even understand what they said. These were not minor criticisms. They said, this is just crap research. If you send the research, the protocol from one university to another university and say, is this something we should be doing with animals? They say, no, I'm down to 1 minute. Okay. My third part is that it doesn't work. It simply is a failure. A study that was just published The National Academy of Sciences just convened a clinical research roundtable in 2000. They published the results in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, in 2003, and they said that there is an assumption that the growth of scientific information about disease heralds a rapid move to improve human health. This illusion is the subject of an intense analysis. They said that we have been seduced for too long by promises that remain unfulfilled. This is the National Academy of Sciences saying that the basic research isn't working. We have to put our money into clinical research and get smart people like Dr. Sangren looking at human disease and not made-up mouse disease. Thank you.
Our first question is for Dr. Sangren. The UW says that all experiments are scrutinized to avoid any that are trivial, uninformative, or redundant, and to minimize animal suffering. For the year ending September 30, 2005, the UW's Animal Care and Use Committees approved 81 exceptions to the standards and regulations of the Animal Welfare Act for various experiments. Can you give us some examples of experiments that the UW has not allowed or that it has insisted be significantly changed?
Well, sure. I can describe that by, in particular, describing the review process. So an investigator who would like to use an animal for any sort of research has to submit what we call a protocol. That is a description of a number of things. First, again, hearkening back to those principles I talked about, the investigator has to state why the subject of study is important to human health, to animal health, to the acquisition of basic knowledge. Second, the investigator has to describe why animals have to be used, why a different system can't be used to address that question. Third, the investigator has to describe all of the steps in the experimental procedures that the animals will be subjected to, how the animals will be evaluated to determine if they had pain or if there's any suffering involved, how they will be treated with analgesic agents, anesthetic agents, for example, and really how they will be monitored to determine when it's time to take them out of the study. So these protocols come before a review committee. Generally, the protocols are first discussed with a laboratory animal veterinarian, an expert in the species involved. So most of the protocols that the committees review are already examined by a veterinarian. I would say that probably a small percent of the protocols that reach the committee, several percent are rejected for a number of different reasons. I would say that about the same percent are accepted as is. And the remaining protocols, so I'm talking 90 or more percent, are sent back to the investigators with questions from the committees. Before that research can begin, those questions have to be addressed. For instance, we may recommend a different pain medication if the study involves surgery, or we may require a stronger justification. So that's how we deal with the issue at the university. So most of the protocols go back once or twice to the investigator.
I'm here to speak to the monkey, and one of the things that he said was
that when they go to the IACUC, they decide when the animals are going to come out of the study. These are the 2005 exceptions. 154 rhesus monkeys housed singly for their lifetime. 67 and 30 rhesus monkeys, rhesus and cynomolgus monkeys housed singly for their lifetime. 30 rhesus housed singly for their lifetime. 30 each one of these are individual. 30 rhesus housed singly for their lifetime. 45 monkeys housed singly for their lifetime. 20 housed singly for their 74 singly for their lifetime. 36 singly for their lifetime. I can get pages and pages. We know that when you put monkeys alone in a cage, that they go nuts. We know that the male rhesus, the male rhesus monkeys, this is such a serious thing to do to them. They're chewing off the ends of their fingers, they're chewing off the ends of their tails. There's published papers talking about how to alleviate this. How do we give them enough environmental enrichment that they don't chew themselves up? These are the things that they're approving. We know the monkeys, it's the golden rule. They won't hurt each other. And yet we're doing this to them. And the National Academies of Science says it's not doing anything for us.
This is a question to you.
Ingrid Newkirk, the president of PETA, has been quoted as saying, even if animal research resulted in a cure for AIDS, we'd be against it. Do you agree with this sentiment?
Yes. Yes. I think that if research on young Catholic girls would lead to a cure for AIDS, I would be against it. And the research has shown unequivocally that the minds of monkeys, the emotions of monkeys, are so like ours that researching on them is not much different than researching on children or researching on adults that have some developmental problem. They're not as smart as we are, but their suffering is just like ours. We can't find a difference in their suffering. We can't find a difference in the way they interact with each other. There was a great study. This is how much like us they are. There was just a study done on capuchin monkeys, and they were giving them tokens and letting them participate in this token economy. One of the things that they found out was that the female capuchin monkeys would take a token in exchange for sex. This shows how they're so much like us. I don't mean that in a flip way. Well, I should have apologized, I have a minute. I should have apologized in my opening remarks, but I wouldn't have got to all my evidence. We should have started this event with a video showing actually what's going on. The lesson from Abu Ghraib is that if people can't see what we're talking about, they don't get it. We can be two talking heads up here and talk about suffering monkeys and talk about all of the things, and even children in hospitals that need medical care. And yet if we don't see it, it somehow doesn't connect with us. I taught elementary school, and I know if I don't show kids pictures of things that we're talking about, they don't get it. And we're not so different than little kids. We have to do something to stop this. The system is spun out of control. We're spending billions of dollars on it, and hundreds of thousands, 500 million mice and rats are used annually in the United States every year for research that does nothing, according to the Academy of Sciences. 10 seconds. I'll let we'll go. We'll save time.
It's a little hard to respond because I'm not sure if you actually responded to the question, but I'd like to respond at least to a few of the comments that you made. Your comment in particular about that National Academy of Science publication, that's something I'd like to address because it's highly relevant, I think, to what we're talking about today. That came out in and around 2003. And here's another publication from the Academy, National Academy of Science, Science, Medicine, and Animals. And it's actually written in very straightforward, simple terms that describes all of the advantages that have come from animal research. And the particular study that Mr. Bogle was talking about was discussed in something called Priority Areas for National Action, Transforming Healthcare Quality. And let me read you a quote. Between each of the priority areas recommended in this report is a patient who may be receiving poor quality care. That's the point that Rick was making. This is due not to a lack of effective treatments. In other words, it's not due to a lack of effective animal research, but to inadequate healthcare delivery systems that fail to implement these treatments. So it's not that the research isn't there, it's that it's not being carried to the patients. That's not a critique of animal research.
Can you just leave off on that? Just make sure we're talking about the same paper.
Pardon? Who's the lead author? I'm just curious if we're talking about the same paper. Is it Soon?
It's the same.
Is it Soon? S-U-N-G? Soon?
The same study.
Is the lead author Soon?
This is not the same publication. It's the same study.
Okay.
Question for Eric. Mm-hmm. Do you personally think animals have rights? And if so, what are they?
So the question is, do I personally think animals have rights? And if so, what are they? I read that definition of rights. And I'll pull that back out again. Moral actions that grow out of respect for the individual that build protective fences around the individual, establish areas where the individual is entitled to be protected against the state and the majority, even when a price is paid by the general welfare. And again, that contrasts with the utilitarian perspective, where you balance the costs with the benefits of something. Right now, animals are generally considered property, and that is one of the outcomes of animal, and that is one of the foundations by which animals are not granted rights in this case.
And do you agree with that?
And personally, right now, yes, I do agree with that notion that animals do not have rights in the sense that humans have rights. Yes.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to respond to that, Mr. Bogle?
Let me just say that the whole notion of rights is a philosophical idea, or as something that's actually granted under law, as something that's been expanding over a period of time. Who's to say what? You know, right now, I guess in Afghanistan, they might kill this guy because he converted to Christianity. Does he have human rights? Well, I think he does, and I don't think he should be killed. So as you move from location to location, it gets kind of strange. But I can't figure out why we wouldn't say that monkeys have a right not to be hurt. Any reason that I could come up with for a reason that I shouldn't hurt you is going to apply to them. Unless, I mean, they're just going to say, well, you look different. That looking different has led us astray many times in the past.
My question for you, and it's a question that I think comes up quite often in the research community, is what specific training or qualifications do you have that allow you to evaluate medical or fairly technical scientific research? What's the background that allows you, and again, I would make this a specific question, to judge the merit of research that might really be useful?
Sure.
I would say that it's my past 10 years of reading and talking to medical doctors and scientists who themselves have looked into this and working with them and writing articles for them and publishing and editing their work for them and doing research for them. But as far as their credential, my credential is I'm an elementary school teacher who can read. And so, what I can do is everybody should learn how to do this. I think every informed citizen in the United States should learn how to search the CRISP database, learn how to use PubMed, be able to find experts in the fields and ask them what is actually going on. I think it's pretty easy to find out what's going on. Now, here's one thing I can't do, is that if we start talking about the very sorts of specific gene insertions and replications that's going on, like in Dr. Sanger's work, he's going to leave me in the dust. But if we're going to talk about basic animal behavior and about what's going on in the labs, I don't don't think you need a very exalted degree to be able to look and see a monkey that's strapped into a chair and see it struggle to try to get away. And I don't think we don't have to go find a PhD to ask us whether the dog that we just kicked is hurt. So I think it's pretty straightforward, most of my claims. The question about the science, I really think it needs to be debated here, and I'm not an expert in the area. We've tried now for a year and a half to get a debate with Dr. Ray Greek, who's an ex-instructor here at the University School of Medicine. His wife's a graduate from the vet school here. He is an expert in this area, and he spent an awful lot of time, written a number of books about it, and he wants to come and debate and talk about just that very narrow question, is the science work? And the university twice have backed out of debating with him once they find out the depth of his knowledge and the degree that he's looked into this. And that's a shame. On a university campus, we should be talking about the facts and ideas and not running away from what people have to say. Did I answer your question? Good.
Sure. I think that one of the things that I've seen during my interaction with the local animal activist community, and that includes attending a number of meetings, as well as some of their discussions of researchers' work that they presented at the union in several sessions, is that there really is a dramatic lack of understanding of how research works by the animal activist community, as evidenced by their presentations. The way science works is that an individual publication is kind of like a building block. And a number of building blocks, maybe 5, maybe 10, maybe 50, are put together, and they build a castle. And that castle is some breakthrough. That castle is some basic knowledge, some basic understanding that we didn't have before. When I hear the activists talking, they pick on one or two papers, explain in poor detail what's going on in those papers, and then say, this just doesn't make any sense at all. If you don't look at the big picture, at the whole context, then you are not going to be able to evaluate whether or not there's any benefit from the work.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, do I get to respond, or did he respond? Never mind.
This is a question for Dr. Sangren. There have been a number of mishaps involving the care of animals at the UW, even a lawsuit against the university alleging animal mistreatment. Why should the public not see this as a sign that there is a problem with oversight and that abuses are occurring?
So, yes, there have been a number of problems in animal care in the university. And whenever there is a system that involves humans or machinery, something like that's going to happen. We strive to be perfect. We don't reach that, nor does anyone else. So the issue is, what do you do when something like that happens? Well, what we do when an event occurs that is bad, we identify why it happened. We make certain that we put into place changes in the systems that we use, changes in our operating procedures to make sure that it doesn't happen again. How, though, do we measure our goals on the way toward perfection? Again, we're aiming for that. We're never going to get there. But how do we evaluate ourselves? And one thing that we have done is to look at hospitals, human hospitals. There was a study published a little over 5 years ago called "To Err is Human" that talked about the problems that develop in human hospitals, where, for example, sometimes 5 or 10% of the time patients receive improper medication, where people don't receive the appropriate treatments before or after a time in the intensive care unit, where they're sent home without the proper medications for myocardial infarction. And it's created a storm of effort in the field of human medicine to try to develop systems to correct these problems. And one of the big issues is whether there should be mandatory reporting or not in the human system. When we compare what we're doing with what is happening in hospitals, we're actually in a far better position. There are far fewer errors that are occurring. We have to report. There's mandatory reporting. So again, we're not perfect, but we are working toward that and have a system that we're always trying to make better.
Well, the United States Department of Agriculture Inspector General's office says that the eastern region is not aggressively pursuing enforcement. It says there's a decrease in the number of referrals to the investigation unit of the USDA. It says there's a failure to take enforcement actions. It says the IACUCs are not effectively monitoring the research facilities. It's just on and on. It says that the system is broken. It says that the research, the oversight isn't doing any good. We know that A. Tarasawa's research was going on for 17 years while the monkeys were strapped into the chair, push-pull perfusions, pumps in and out of their chemicals in and out of their brains. The USDA, the rare time that they actually found something wrong, they came in and they go, hey, you know, we learned a monkey died in the chair. And Dr. Sangren said, that, you know, we'll suspend her. That shows the system is working. I'm sorry, it was going on for 17 years and they didn't find it. The system doesn't work. And the research, the little bit of research that's been done on this by third parties says it doesn't either.
Second question for you. You have protested outside UW's researchers' home showing footage of research they had nothing to do with to stigmatize and embarrass them. In 2003, you emailed several researchers calling them slime and saying your elimination is justified. You are a cancer. You are a blight. What gives you the right to vilify and threaten? Is it your intention to make researchers feel afraid?
Well, I knew that question was coming. Right. The extreme. Let's do the first extreme statements first, because I mean I have to admit that I did send that email. I sent it to random people. I know how to use the CRISP database, and I have 100 people. I wrote this very nasty email, and I blame Charles Shaw. I don't know if you're from California, but Charles Shaw puts out a wine, we call it Two Buck Chuck in California, and at the end of a bottle of Chardonnay, my better judgment went out the window, and I wrote a really nasty letter to these people. And that's true, I did do that. What can I say, it was after a bottle of wine. We did park the Tiger truck, this truck with these giant screens on it in front of vivisectors' homes. And a lot of people have taken me to task for that. But let me tell you, this is the second debate that I've been engaged in here in almost 8 years. The first debate that I was engaged in here, it took place in the Great Hall, and this was like 7.5, 8 years ago. And that debate came on the heels of a home demonstration in front of Joe Chemnitz's house. Joe Chemnitz is the director of the Fleming Center. The second debate, here we are, after parking this big truck in front of people's houses. What a crazy thing to have to do to stimulate this sort of discussion, this open discussion that the whole community can hear. But if they're not going to talk about it, if they're not going to talk about what's going on with the monkeys in the labs, then we'll just keep doing that. We don't want to, this is what we want to do. This is what we want to do, is we want to talk about the issue and draw the public's attention to the issue and let you guys make a decision. But if the university decides that they're not going to talk anymore, then what is the appropriate response for us? Just go home. Oh well, they don't want to talk.
Yeah, I'd like to respond in two ways. Number one, Mr. Vogel seems to hold himself and his colleagues to a very different standard than he holds us. How would any of you have felt if we tried to justify the mistakes that happened and when animals are injured by saying, oh, well, we just had a bottle of Chardonnay? That's just not the way it works when you're in the back. Point number two, Mr. Vogel's math isn't quite right. Before the Tiger trucks came this time, I was in conversation with another activist, and we were actually talking about a series of three debates. When the Tiger truck came, that became impossible. In fact, this debate almost didn't happen. I mean, why should a community engage in people that are intimidating and harassing, that are running up onto their doorsteps, banging on their door, shouting obscenities through microphones? So actually, the net loss from the Tiger trucks in this case was two debates.
My question is for you, Dr. Sangren. There's a perception that the method of funding for animal research is historically supportive and unquestioning, and that it perpetuates the use of animal models and discourages work toward alternatives. Do you think there's any basis for that or any need for change?
No, there's no basis for that. In order for a project to be funded, any kind of scientific project from the federal agencies, an investigator has to write an application, and this application is reviewed by a panel of other scientists. Those scientists are expert in that particular field, but they will not all use animals in research. Some will, many won't. In order to convince that panel that your study is worthy of funding, you have to be you have to explain why the question that you're asking, the medical advance you're trying to find, is important enough to be studied. You have to justify why animals are used in that study. I have, actually, this is a petri dish, and many studies are conducted in petri dishes like this. And you can all see that it's this, by the way, I'm not violating any biosafety policies. There aren't any cells in here, but there'd be this just little covering on the bottom of this if this were filled with cells. This is a petri dish. This is a living organism. Now, you may think this is more attractive than this particular living organism, but you all have to admit they're very different. So the scientists have to match the way they're going to address the question with the question that they're actually asking. They have to be able to justify the use of animals. And then they actually have to describe how they'll do the research, how they'll interpret the results, et cetera. And at this stage, about 15% of all of the applications that are sent in are actually getting funded. It's incredibly competitive right now. If a scientist chooses the wrong model, if a scientist chooses to use animals when something like a culture dish would work or when some other method would work, then there will be no funding granted.
Would you also respond to that, Mr. Vogel?
Just really quickly, the National Academy of Sciences says that, in fact, this is a national crisis of major proportions, a clarion call to action. This is actually the editorial in JAMA that accompanied the report. No less needed than the response to September 11th is required to save lives. These are strong words, but they are needed. Their primary claim is that the money that we're spending on basic research is actually interfering with clinical research. There's this huge balloon of knowledge coming out, and as NIH gives money to or allocates money for that sort of funding, it's the clinical researchers are not being able to compete to get the money to do the research that actually would save our lives.
And my next question is directly to you. Let's say, as I think many people would believe, that your long-term goal is elimination of animal research. Are you willing to set short-term goals? And if so, specifically, what might they be?
Yes, I'm willing to set short-term goals. My first short-term goal is close to the primate center. And then we'll look at the dogs, and then we'll look at the cats. So, yes, there are short-term goals. I think that I don't think that it would be appropriate to say, well, you know, if we could just end some types of studies at the primate center, that would be a way to go, or that if we could reduce the number of animals. If it's wrong, it's wrong. And so trying to somehow limit that in some way to say that we just need to do a better job at oversight. If only the oversight system worked. If only the IACUCs around the country, when they reviewed studies, they actually all thought it was reasonable research. What that does is it's based on the idea that we have that we have a right to hurt them. And I don't believe that we do. I think that just like you have a right not to be hurt by me, I think that the monkeys in the labs, the ones that refuse to pull the chains and shock their neighbor, I think they have a right not to be hurt as well. And so, no, I don't, I mean, there are some sort of stepwise things that we have to do, but I'm not looking for larger cages. We're not looking for more fruit. We're not looking for, kinder care techs at the labs, anything like that. There's enough information out there and enough of a foundation to make the claim that the primate center should be closed. All of the primate centers in the United States should be closed.
And would you like to respond to that, Dr. Sangren?
Sure. The issue of incremental change is an important one, not just from Mr. Bogle's perspective, but also from our perspective. There are efforts to reduce the number of animals that are used. There are efforts to refine the types of studies that are performed so that they will be less invasive, cause less pain. There are efforts to replace animal use with other kinds of methodologies, such as culture dishes. And in fact, that goes on all the time. Animal studies are used to find studies that to identify ways of not using animals. So certainly from the perspective of the animal research community, we do take incremental steps all the time. And in fact, he made a comment about Dr. Chirasawa's work, mentioning that it had been going on for 17 years. And I think that is actually an example of refinement. I was asked by his group if there was a procedure that we no longer allow, and other things have come up that allow that information to be gained. So it's no longer used. That's an example of an incremental step.
My question to you, Dr. Sangren, is whether you foresee a day when other methods will allow greatly reduced reliance on animals as research subjects, and what needs to happen for that day to come. But I'll add too that the UW last year had 2,000 non-human primates, various monkeys that is, 673 dogs, 450 pigs that they used in experiments. If indeed these incremental steps are being taken already, why aren't these numbers going down?
Did you say why are the numbers going down?
Why aren't they going down? Why are there as many monkeys and dogs and hamsters and pigs as being used in experiments as there ever were?
Well, one way to look at that is that there are far more experiments being done on this campus now than there were before, and yet the use of animals has stayed relatively steady. We're being successful here on this campus. We're gaining new knowledge, stem cell development, for example, which, to address the first part of your question, do I foresee a day when we can reduce the use of animals? I think the stem cell technology will ultimately lead to a reduction in the need to use animals, and that was developed through the use of animals. Another example of how we can reduce animal studies. The number of animals that are used on this campus reflects really the type of research that is ongoing, and so if we're more successful with research, and yet we're not using additional animals, that suggests that we're actually reducing the overall use on a per-study basis. It also will vary on a campus basis depending on the kinds of questions that are being asked, the type of information that's being being requested. If we want to answer certain complex questions, for instance, how the effects of a particular part of the brain affect other parts of the body, you're not going to be able to do that by working in a tissue culture dish. You need to use a living organism to address that. So as long as those kinds of questions still remain, as long as there's anything we don't know about how a body works, there will be a need to use living bodies in experimental studies. And so I don't know that I foresee a day when animal use will ever be abolished. Certainly I think that there will be reductions in some areas and expansions in others, for example, in rodents, where we have the ability to change the genes and look at the effects of that on the overall health of the animal.
Rick, your response?
Not too many years ago, there was a pretty good estimate that said there were about 30 million mice and rats used in the United States for research annually. The most current estimate says that number is now at 500 million. The number of animals that we're using isn't staying the same. It's going up. It's skyrocketing. It's primarily skyrocketing because of all the transgenic mice that are being used. There's all sorts of crazy things about the number of mice it takes to generate a single mouse with the right genetic characteristics. The numbers of monkeys and dogs and cats, those numbers are actually staying fairly stable. But there's about a million of the animals that are covered under the Animal Welfare Act. 500 million are not covered under the Animal Welfare Act. And that number is just skyrocketing because there's so much money out there for people that want to do this sort of research. It's just false. The other thing is Dr. Sangren says if you want to learn about bodies, you've got to study bodies. Our claim is that if you want to learn about human bodies, you've got to study human bodies. If you want to learn about mice, you study mice. If you're a veterinarian, you're studying dog disease, don't go study pigs, study dogs.
A question for you. You've used the term Holocaust
to describe what is happening in the realm of animal research. How do you justify the use of this term in connection with this issue?
That was a question for me. Had to be.
That is.
Okay. I misunderstood. How do I use that term? Well, you know, what I've said is that I haven't said that it's like a Holocaust. What I said was, in the literature that I've written, I said that during the Holocaust, if people would have spoken out, if the people in Germany, if during the Holocaust, they would have spoken out, maybe it wouldn't have occurred. Maybe it would have stopped sooner. When I was teaching sixth grade, I was in Oregon. World history. And my students always ask me, when we talked about things like slavery, we talked about the killing fields in Cambodia or the Holocaust or any sort of horrible thing that went on in history, my students always ask me this, and I've since learned that, in fact, other teachers, their students ask them this too. They said, why did people let things like that go on? You know, they all shake their heads about how horrible it is, but they just couldn't understand. They just didn't believe that people would just sit idly by while those things happened. We all wanted to believe, the kids in my classroom and me, we always wanted to believe that we'd be one of the people who had a Jew hidden in our basement, who would help somebody along the Underground Railway. So in that sense, it is like the Holocaust. Because the Holocaust occurred because people stayed quiet, because people were afraid to say anything. And I don't want to be one of those people. What I've learned about what's going on at the Primate Center is so horrible, and the monkeys are so like us, that I have to speak out. If I don't speak out, I would have been one of those people in those past days that didn't say anything, that was too afraid, would be afraid to say that, yeah, I drank a bottle of wine, I made an ass of myself. But the reason that I got to that point was because I'm so angry about people like Dr. Sanger that will stand up here and say, we just have to do this, and let's talk about what Jeremy Bentham had to say. It just pisses me off. The things that are going on in the lab are so fucking horrible. We have to do something about it. We have to stop it.
Dr. Sanger, your response.
Sure. A lot of us look around the population in this country and we see or know people with cancer. We know people with Parkinson's disease. We know people that have dystonia, a disorder that was discussed not too long ago in the Wisconsin State Journal, how it's being treated methods that are actually used in primates as well. Cardiovascular disease, and the effects of smoking, which killed my own father. I look around at those, and many of the rest of us look around at those, and we say, we're not going to just let that happen. We're going to try to understand why that's happening. We're going to use appropriate methods to study that, to develop treatments for that, so that those disorders can go away. We will not stand idly by while that happens. The same thing is true, actually, in veterinary medicine. We will do tests to evaluate the effect of vaccines on dogs. So we also won't just stand by and let things happen.
I have one last question for Mr. Bogle, which is a follow-up question, actually. You made an oblique reference to not to the section in the Animal Welfare Act which has to do with psychological well-being of primates, fruit, toys, bigger cages. My question for you is this. Given the fact that you're focused on a long-term goal, the elimination, say, of the Primate Center and primate research, what, if anything, are you doing today that helps the monkeys now being used in primate research?
I'm standing here speaking to them. That's what I'm doing for them. I don't think that those are your words, it's a long-term goal. You know, when I think about long-term and how long these things are going to happen, my claim is that a week before the Berlin Wall fell, nobody knew it was going to happen. And it happened like that. And all of a sudden, the Iron Curtain came down and things changed. I think things can change. And I think the reason that things aren't changing very rapidly is because there's not good discussion. There's not much information out in the public realm. Most people aren't able. I bet you that if we go up to, say, Easttown Mall, people coming out, and we stop and say, can you describe one of the experiments that's going on at the Primate Center? I'll bet you pennies to dollars that we're not going to find very many people, even here in Madison, that are going to be able to do that. I don't think the public really knows what's going on. And so the claim that it's going to take a long time, I don't believe. I really do believe in education. Let me real quickly say, jump back, and I know I'm going to steal a little bit of time here, but
I understand. I think that Dr. Sangren is absolutely honest when he says that the people that are working in animal research often are driven because they see sick people around. And these are the sorts of, we see a headline, Progress Against Parkinson's. You know, that's a big headline, Progress Against Parkinson's. And then you read, Study Finds Therapy That Works in Rats. It's not a headline about Parkinson's, about it working in humans. And that's what the National Academies of Science are saying. They're saying there's this huge balloon of scientific information, and it's not translating to care in the hospitals. This is not me. I'm not making this up. This is the National Academy of Science. They're saying that there's this bottleneck, and we've got all this information. And it's an illusion that we think that just more and more papers about mice and rats and dogs and cats is going to lead to something. It's just not true. And the people that have taken the time to look at that, they say, you know what? We were deluded. That's what they actually say in the report. We were deluded. And now they have all sorts of reasons about how to fix it. Right.
Do you want to respond to something specifically interested in what a university might be doing regarding psychological well-being of primates?
That is one of the things that's reviewed by the Animal Care and Use Committee. We did just have a report from the Primate Center regarding the types of enrichment, and there are multiple kinds of enrichment that go on. 95% or more of the animals are housed with other animals. Animals that are housed alone are those who have demonstrated a behavioral dislike of other animals, for example. So if there's fighting and if they want to be alone, then they're alone. Some animals are in specific studies where their diet is being measured, so they have to be studied alone, but then later on they'll be paired with other animals. So it's not just animals spending all of their lives alone. So there's the housing, there's the enrichment, there's a very strong enrichment program there at the Primate Center.
Thank you. We're now going to move to the section of the program in which we ask the panelists questions that have been raised by members of the audience. And we're going to alternate between panelists as we have. I'm going to begin by loosely combining a couple of questions for you, Mr. Bogle.
Sure.
And they are this. Would you be willing to be the first human to take a drug never tested in the animal? And as a corollary, would you refuse medication or a surgical or medical procedure developed in animals?
Well, it's two questions. It's one, would I take a medication that hadn't been tested on animals? And yes, I would, if there had been enough research that looked at it and in ways that I thought was appropriate. It's interesting. Did you see the story about the six guys that were given in England, they were just given the injection of the new drug, and they all went into comas, and they swole up, and they had to be on life support and all this. They had tried that, according to all the articles in the paper, they had tried that on two monkeys, and they had slight swelling in their glands. And so, it was tested on a monkey. I trust it. They injected it into those guys, and they went into comas almost immediately. So I don't know what the animal testing does. Every drug out there that's been pulled off the shelf has been tested on animals. Every drug out there that kills people has been tested on animals. So the testing on animals is a meaningless sort of step. What was the second part?
Would you volunteer to be a test subject?
Sure.
You would?
Sure.
Well, I think we've probably got available researchers here to take you up in there. Dr. Sangren, given your premise that primate research is beneficial and ethical, why is it so difficult for the public to actually observe it? Why is it so not transparent to those who might be interested? Why is the public not allowed into the Primate Center?
Well, there are a lot of ways in which the process is incredibly transparent. The studies that are done using those animals are published, that's how science thrives. So there's a transparency in terms of the publications. There's a transparency in terms of a discussion in non-scientific terms of what goes on at the Primate Center by press releases, by news releases from the university, and by articles published in the press that describe that. In terms of transparency regarding having people coming through the Primate Center, well, there are two principal issues there. One is security. There are many
places around the country that have been vandalized and often animals hurt. The second is that we want to protect the animals. They're highly susceptible to certain diseases that humans have, and so we want to protect them from being infected. I have to have a TB test twice a year to make sure I don't have tuberculosis to go in there. The third reason is we want people to be protected from the monkeys. There are certain diseases that are transmissible from the monkeys to humans. So it makes very poor public health sense, and it makes very poor animal health sense to have people trooping through there, aside from the fact that it would also greatly disturb the animals.
How can you possibly compare cancer to the Holocaust?
Dr. Sanger's answer about why it's so hard to find out what's going on and that the animals would be bothered and those sorts of things. I want to point out that actually there's been a change over time. This is a Newsweek cover from 1971. It's a picture of a monkey with a thing stuck in his head. This is a picture from just last year where this other research going on, but it's been very carefully cropped. So that what you see in the news, this is also Newsweek, same magazine, just years apart. And this is what we see, this actually for people that are watching this stuff, used to be able to see news magazines, Life magazine, Time, news, and they would frequently have these science exposés, and you'd see all these animals and all these various weird sorts of contraptions and experiments being done on them. You don't see that anymore. And it's not because I'm going to get a disease from looking at the picture, or they're going to be frightened because I look at their picture. It's because there's a public relations engine out there and machine that says we have to keep this stuff under wraps. We really don't want people to know what's going on. When we get information from the Climate Center, it's heavily redacted, page after page after page of redactions.
Mr. Bottle, I have a question from the audience that raises the issue of whether you could be described as a speciesist. You spent most of the night talking about non-human primates and their treatment at the University of Wisconsin. Are you anthropomorphizing? Are you just focusing on primates and don't actually care about rodents, guinea pigs, dogs, cats?
Well, I think I've mentioned the idea that, the fact that there's 500 million mice and rats being used in the United States. I've known rats. I have high regard for rats. But the reason I talk about monkeys is because I think the evidence that we can lay out there about the similarities are easier for most people to understand. The people that are doing the brain and the psychology experiments on monkeys make the claims overtly that their minds are like ours. Dr. Koh, the head of the Harlow Lab here, says that monkeys, like humans, can reason 20 steps into the future. I'm sorry, it's Caitlin, not Koh, I misspoke. So that's why I talk about monkeys, is that I think that there's more traction for the topic. Am I a speciesist? Actually, no, I was a Peace Corps volunteer and I've done a lot of community work. I like people too. So I'm not really a speciesist. So,
Dr. Sangren, you made an impression on someone in the audience that you seem to feel that morality is an issue of cost-benefit analysis. Don't you think there is more to morality than that? Do you think that experimenting on humans would be appropriate if the benefit outweighed the harm?
Well, a couple of ways of answering that question. The ethical philosophy of utilitarianism weighs costs with benefits. And that's not something that just I use. That's a very common philosophy. And as mentioned by Gary Francione, an animal rights activist, that is the philosophy that most animal activists hold. In fact, Gary Francione states that the organization PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, also holds the same utilitarian perspective based on their actions and their statements. I like to have as little in common with them as possible, but in this case, that's something that we do share. In terms of the rest of the second part of the question?
The question was, don't you think that there is a higher morality than that? And would you, on that cost-benefit basis, approve invasive research on humans if the benefit outweighed the harm?
We have a notion of human rights, which I think is a very important notion, and I think, as Mr. Bogle pointed out, around the world, the human rights issues still remain to be solved. So in terms of invasive research on humans, no, I don't believe that's appropriate. In terms of research on humans, informed consent, yes, that's appropriate, and it's done all the time.
Would you like to respond to
that? Not all the time. We do informed consent research on people all the time.
There's really incredible brain research going on in people right here at the university. There's wonderful research going on here at the university. There's no question about that. I was just reading today research looking at children, twins, and all these brain things, frightening kids, putting them in brain scans and scaring them. It's pretty interesting stuff to see what's going on in their brains. And that makes sense. Then we actually are learning something that's immediately, now we know something about people. You know? So, yeah.
This may seem slightly in the line of that earlier question about Ingrid Newkirk and curing AIDS, but there's a member of the audience who points out that monkeys, rhesus macaques mostly, actually, were used to help cure polio. Do you think those experiments were worth it?
You know, the problem with that is that so many of these claims are really hard to sort of tease apart. The truth about the matter, or at least part of the truth about the matter with monkeys and polio, was that the Nobel Prize was awarded when people learned how to grow the virus in a petri dish. It wasn't awarded for infecting monkeys with polio. For a generation, polio it ran amok because they had discovered in monkeys that you could take the brain of a monkey who had been given polio, emulsify it, and shove it up the nose of another monkey, and that monkey would get polio. Research using humans had shown that polio was transferred orally, and that research languished because they couldn't reproduce those effects in people. And so for about a generation, more people got polio because the animal models, the monkey models, proved that in fact it was an airborne thing. So, you know, it's these things, it's a cost-benefit thing, isn't it? How many people died, got polio because of the monkey research?
Would you like to respond to that one, Dr. Sengren?
I think just the generation of what are the advantages, what have been the advantages of animal research, that is something I think everyone should look into. It's not so hard to find that out. There are a couple of tables outside where you can get information from both perspectives. Take some of that information from each and look into it. Look into the story of polio. Look into the story of innumerable other advances that have been developed through the use of animals. I think a relatively simple internet search now is sufficient really to give you that sort of information. Claims that animal research really haven't produced any benefits are an example of that rhetorical technique of the big lie. You say something so outrageous that it takes people off guard, and they say, well, gee, the person wouldn't say something like that unless there was some truth to it. And I'm afraid that's really a lot of what we hear from the animal activists. So take some time to get the information that's outside the door and look at both sides of it.
My next question, the next question from the audience is for you, Dr. Sengren. And it has to do with how aggressively, I think, animal care and use committees pursue holding researchers to standards of care for their animals. The question is, when you expect facilities or when you are reviewing a protocol, do you ask to witness the procedures? Do you actually observe how the researcher might care for the animals, such as in chairing blood draws or TB testing?
So every animal committee that has that reviews the protocols has a laboratory animal veterinarian on that committee. Most of them have several, and that is a legal requirement. For many protocols, we as a committee specifically ask that a procedure be monitored, particularly if it's being done for the first time, by the laboratory animal veterinarian. So that's actually a very common thing. Most of the studies, certainly those done on primates, most of the experimentation and the surgeries are done by veterinarians, so they are trained in that particular aspect of animal of handling animals. So yes, there is a lot of follow-up when we approve protocols of procedures, particularly complex procedures, and generally we do that through the use of veterinarians who are trained in the area.
Okay.
Can I respond to that?
Yes, you may.
the way I understood his answer was, the answer was no, that in fact everybody on the committee, or at least Dr. Sangren, doesn't go and observe what's going to be done to the animals, that they're going to be chaired. They take the counsel of someone who is apparently on the committee, who apparently has seen a similar thing, or maybe even that procedure, but the whole committee doesn't seem to go. And he said they asked the veterinarians that are on the committee about this thing. I think the whole committee should go, wouldn't it? If the committee is supposed to give its oversight, its approval, one of those committee members is supposed to be a member of the public, why aren't the people that are going to make that decision about whether that's the appropriate thing to do, why don't they go watch the procedure?
Did he characterize your response correctly?
We asked the veterinarian to go examine the procedures because they have expertise in that area.
So that was it.
Yeah. It's also true that any member of the committee can go and watch any procedure at any time. And we do have inspections where we do watch procedures. We don't watch every procedure, but we do have inspections where we watch many procedures. We also have a training program, and we also have ways of monitoring the training that people have received. So we have a number of different ways to help us ensure that people are doing things the way they're supposed to.
And I get the impression you still feel that's inadequate.
Well, I mean, it's not clear to me, it wasn't entirely clear what he said to me. I'm not sure that, in fact, he says, I understand that they can go watch any time that they want, but I'm curious as to when a new protocol comes along and they say that we want to do this, does the public member go and watch before they make their decision?
Specifically the public member, and what I'm going to end this
because
line.
Because the other people are so embedded in the system, they probably don't need to. They have an idea what's going on. Does the public member go and watch?
Any of the members don't routinely go and watch every procedure that's done.
No, I know.
That's not necessary.
I'm talking for a brand new protocol that we're talking about.
Yes, and what he's saying is that...
They could if they wanted to.
They
of course, I understand that.
Okay. There's quite a bit of concern out here about this issue of testing of drugs on animals and your characterization of them. So I'm going to just read this one.
Sure.
There are more drugs and medicines available now than ever before. Our quality of health care and our medications, according to this questioner, are unrivaled. Since all drugs and most treatments are tested on animals before they reach humans, how can you really justify saying that animal testing has not contributed?
Well, if you read the journals, what you find is that many of the clinicians are saying that, and this is, you know, these articles are fairly common, and there's a lament in the medical world that the new drugs that come out don't seem to be much better than the old drugs. There's often what's happening is that this is why you really need to have Dr. Greek here instead of me. But it looks like many of the new drugs that are coming out are slight modifications in old drugs, and there's not a lot of new things out there as far as drugs are concerned. And at least that's what the clinicians say in their own journals, that it often isn't an improvement.
And in fact, Dr. Sangren, one of the questions follows up on the point Mr. Bogle just made. Isn't it true that researchers are giving grants over and over again to reinvent the wheel, fine-tune what's already there, repeat the same research?
Well, I talked before about the process by which grants and funding for grants is evaluated. And if somebody is simply reproducing the wheel, that grant will not be funded. They have to carry something further. Past the area of knowledge that it has reached before. So you can have a grant that has the same title for 25 years, but you're building on knowledge and you're increasing knowledge, you're improving knowledge. And actually now through the use of animals, and in particular some of the genetically engineered animals, there are a lot of new medications that are not just slight modifications of old drugs, but are major modifications, new classes of drugs entirely, that are starting to come out. It's an issue of getting the clinicians to use them, but that's a separate issue. That's not an issue regarding animal research. So yes, all of the drugs have to be tested. There are new drugs coming out, many of them from this campus. It's not just a slight modification of old drugs.
Mr. Bogle, would you advocate, given the problems that you've raised about animal research, that new therapies for childhood disease be tested in children then as a more accurate model and not first in animals?
Well, in fact, we are tested in children. You know what happens when we... Right, well, here's the problem. Here's the problem with all this stuff, or one of the problems, is that you test the drug, the new drug, in a particular strain of mouse, and you have this effect. You test that drug in a rat, and you have this different effect. You test the drug in a monkey or a different species of monkey. And so what you get is a scattergram. You get, well, it works this way in these species or this way in these strains of mice, but not those strains of mice. And then if you think that it still has hope, then you're going to test it on children. But which one of those results was right?
Well, just to pursue this thought a little bit farther, if we take your argument that no other species completely replicates the human species, which is right, wouldn't then by that argument, and I'm sort of resetting the question I asked earlier, it make more sense to go directly to the source? And in fact, if we're going to argue that monkeys and children are sort of mentally similar in terms of cognition and ability to feel pain, what then, in your opinion, would be a barrier to testing a drug first in children? Or would there be a barrier?
I'm not sure I totally got your question.
You would then argue that we should go straight to the source and test drugs for children in children, skipping the animal model entirely?
Well, yes, I think we should skip the animal model because it's misleading, because sometimes it gives us false positives, false negatives, and we never know ahead of time. It's just a crap. And so we have a 50-50 chance. Were the animal models right or were they wrong? I don't know. So, but we still go ahead. Oftentimes, we're actually beginning testing in human even while the animal testing is still occurring. That's what FDA says, we can do that now. And so the animal testing doesn't seem to inform us one way or the other. We tested the stuff on the monkeys and their glands swell up, so we gave it to the humans and they swell up and almost died. And this happens again and again and again, or it doesn't do anything at all. And so what we do with the people, and all the drugs are this way, we're going to do some microdosing on a very few number of people and look and make sure that there's no untoward reaction to that drug. Then we're going to increase the number of people, we're going to increase the dosage a little bit and see what happens, and if everything, they seem to weather the drug okay, then we're going to move it into then a phase 3 trial with a larger number of people, and then we're going, and that point is when we're going to decide, is the drug efficacious? Does the drug actually work? And in fact, most of the times it doesn't, because we'd even got there in the first place because we'd shown that it worked in mice.
But the question is then, do you advocate simply doing the testing in children for childhood diseases and adults for adult diseases? Total elimination of animal models, all research done in humans.
Well, there's all the prior work with right tissue cells and all of those sorts of things. But yes, when you need a whole organism to test in, that first time you do it should be in a person.
Okay, thank you.
A child or an adult or a geriatrics person or a person with whatever. Yeah, of
thank
course.
Thank you.
Of course.
Do you want to address that issue at all?
Yes. There are differences between animals and humans. We all agree on that. Some of us use that in different ways. You say that monkeys are very similar to humans, then you say they're very different from humans in terms of their responses to chemicals. I think the...
Monkeys are very much like ours.
Yeah. And so when drugs are tested on animals are used as a screening tool. Culture dishes are used as a screening tool. There are multiple screening steps that go into the development of a particular drug before it's used in humans. We can eliminate 90% of the drugs that are not likely to work in humans by using animals. We still then have to test them in humans, and we won't know exactly what will happen, but we're far better off in terms of what we do know. We're far more likely to identify drugs that will be effective, and we're far more likely to eliminate drugs that won't be effective by using the animal testing first. You can always talk about examples where there are drugs that give bad reactions, but by far and away, most drugs that are on the market now do not give bad reactions, and a principal reason for that is because they were testing in animals.
Dr. Sanger, this is the final question.
Right.
How does the university feel about retiring primates involved in research into sanctuaries? A few animals from Vilas were sent to a sanctuary, but have there been any other since? What is the primary reason why monkeys, research monkeys, are not retired from the University of Wisconsin?
So the issue of disposition of animals is really not something that I'm involved in. That's not a part of my decision-making process. I do know that there is not an absolute prohibition. I do know that occasionally some animals are sent to retirement areas. If using an animal in a particular study requires at the end that animal be killed and its tissues be looked at, if that's part of the experimental design, then of course that will not go to a retirement place. But you mentioned some of the Vilas animals, and there are some others as well that occasionally do. So there's not an absolute prohibition against that. But I don't know precisely what any policy is.
Mr. Barber, do you want to address the issue of what might happen, say, to animals if the primate center was closed, the issue of retiring research monkeys?
Well, we had 150 monkeys that we could have retired from the zoo, and we had somebody standing by willing to take the monkeys. We had people coming up with money to pay for their relocation, and the university said, go to hell, we're sending them to Tulane to be used in infectious disease research. These were monkeys that the university had signed an agreement with Dane County, saying that those monkeys wouldn't be used in any harmful ways. And once we discovered that the agreements that the university had signed with Dane County had been violated for 8 years, that 200 monkeys had been secretly taken from the zoo, once that became public knowledge, the university said, the monkeys are out of here. They also told us that where we wanted to send the monkeys was a roadside zoo. They would never send monkeys to a place like that. So then once they sent the 100 rhesus monkeys there, then they didn't have anything to do with the stump-tailed monkeys, because those monkeys, nobody wanted them for research. They're not used very often. So they sent them to that roadside zoo that they said they would never send the rhesus monkeys to.
We now come to the conclusion of our program. Each panelist will have 2 minutes for a closing statement. We'll start with Dr. Sanger and end with Mr. Vogel.
What I'd like to do first, it's a reasonably divided audience, and that's probably good. I'd like to thank the members of this audience who are involved in animal research in one way or another, animal caretakers, scientists who work with animals to try to gain knowledge, technicians, people who are involved in the regulatory process. We're working to improve human health. We're working to improve animal health, and those are good objectives. From our perspective, we believe that the results of that work make the world a better place. The second thing I'd like to do is talk a bit about why this event is occurring at all. There is polarization on each side. And one of the reasons that I went to a couple of meetings of a local animal activist group and initiated a dialogue there was because I wanted to see if there was a way of reducing that polarization, at least stopping the spread and keep it from getting worse. What I've heard, and I hear this on both sides, is that no one really is willing to try to meet anywhere near the middle because of actions that the other group has taken. So there was a lot of discussion on the campus whether this debate should occur, and I think that was very legitimate discussion because it's occurring with someone who intimidated and harassed members of our campus community. And when we talk to the activists about their use of those techniques, they say, it's because you won't communicate with us. So that's a stalemate. So what I've done tonight is taken the first step, and actually I've taken a few steps before. And I think the way that we can judge the success of tonight will be whether or not now the activists take another step, whether they reduce and stop, whether they stop entirely the intimidation and harassment, whether they stop the phone call death threats that are occurring to faculty members right now, whether they stop sending harassing mail. And I think that if that happens, if the activists now will also take a step, then maybe we'll be able to take more steps after this. That's my hope, at least. Thank you.
I don't know anything about people sending death threats, so I'm sorry if they are. I certainly appreciate the fact that that Dr. Sangren decided to come in and talk for and share his thoughts with us, no matter what his reasons are. I think it's good that he's doing that. I think that a university is the sort of place where these kind of ideas need to be aired. I think it's the appropriate thing to do. I think that the reason that you see escalations and tactics and people doing things that people think are untoward is because our perspective is that the industry is very, very closed. Just like I showed you with the pictures, is that there really is this clamping down on information. Well, I just want to read you a couple quotes. Jane Goodall spoke here in 1993. I don't think Jane Goodall is a terrorist. She said, "The point is, do rhesus monkeys have emotions? Do they have feelings? Do they have pain? Do they have sophisticated social structures?" And all the answers are yes. A previous veterinarian at the Primate Center here, Victor Reinhardt, said right now on his website, he says, "Is it really so far-fetched to compare this situation with that of human prisoners kept in a concentration camp?" There's so much to talk about, and I hope that you will continue to educate yourself. I would recommend two websites. If you want to know what's going on at the Primate Center, go to madisonmonkeys.com. If you want to find out about the science and learn something about people other than what the animal researchers have to say, go to curedisease.com. I think we need something more than assertions and reassurances from people who are vested in the industry. We have to have third parties come in and look. I think we do need that third party look at the situation that's going on and then help us understand it. So anyway, I really thank everybody for coming. It was great. Look how many people came. This issue really is important to people. It's great that everybody came. Thank you very much.
That does conclude our program. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to our panelists and to all of the people who pulled together and make this happen, especially Liz Beiler of the UW, Matt, our timekeeper, Matt Rink of the Contemporary Issues Committee, and my colleagues at ISMIS, Linda Baldwin, Vicki Kratz, and Janine Wachter. Thank you. Good night.